Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What time is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
It's okay, everybody. If we just stay strong, we can get through this podcast episode together. It will not be easy. There will almost certainly be some gloating, but I believe the only way to handle it is to confront this head on. So please join me in saying these three words to Murph, and then we can all move on with our lives. Murph. Oh, I don't know if I can say it. Murph. No, yeah, I can't say it.
You don't have to say it. I know it anyway. So
what was I going to say? What were my three words?
You were right.
You were right were my three words. You said them for me about the Scots. You were right. Welcome to Monday Set Captain Six Nations podcast. Thank God that's over with. Hi, Ken.
Hello, and how are you?
Of course they played scintillating rugby to open up a 14-point lead, only to throw it away with a man sent off. And even then, they butchered their chances to win it. Of course. We should have known. Murph told us all along it's the Scottish rugby team. We always should have doubted them.
It's the Scotland rugby team, the sporting world's greatest pinata. Come on. I didn't doubt them. I didn't doubt them for a second.
No.
All these people getting on to me in the first half, you included, of course, but I mean, that's fine. I don't hold it against people if they refuse to believe their eyes and ears. What I was shocked by in that first half was that people seemed not to expect the game to go exactly like this. I mean, did you think that a Scottish team this talented up against a Wales team that bad were going to be engaged in some sort of like dour goal kicking fest, which, you know, is going to be decided by, you know, a Lee Halfpenny kick from the halfway line, a little squeaky win for Wales? I mean, this is what it's all about. I tried to explain this to you last Monday. This was never about Scotland being terrible. It's about Scotland being hilarious. When someone shows you who they are, believe them. Was I nervous, Owen? Well, my only concern beforehand was that Wales were going to improve just enough for Scotland to be able to beat them. But once I saw that Wales really were terrible enough, talentless enough to win the game in that first half, I could relax and really enjoy my rugby on. Because that's what this is all about, isn't it? Enjoying your rugby.
I see what you're saying here. Once a team gets too good, that's when Scotland pounce and
could beat them.
Okay,
yeah.
I see what you're saying. But when there's expectation, yeah.
But the lesson that can be learned from by Scotland here, if they're inclined to learn their lessons, is that if you find yourself 14 points up against really, really crap opponents at home, don't hang about. Get yourself a man sent off immediately. Don't wait for the second half. Don't do it. The second try goes in, get a man sent off. If they'd gone down to 14 men a little earlier, they might have had a chance of winning that game, Owen. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, my word. We had a new feature last week. Watchhog, I believe you called it, Murph. Myself and Ken fixed it for you a little bit to Hogwatch. But Owen Keane got on to say, did you completely disregard Hogglebox? Which I think is what we've got to go with now. It follows the Six Nations fortunes of Scotland's boastful captain. Went pretty well for him last week, in fairness. So please, Kieran, over to you for episode 2 of Hogglebox.
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up winning the bloody World Cup. I love it.
Stuart Hogg. I believed in the boys' ability.
Man of the match.
Scotland are a disgrace to work for. Ah, Stuart Hogg on. Stuart Hogg. He scored two wonderful tries, of course. His hair still looked demoxenal levels of grit, but perhaps the key moment was his Devon Locke impersonation after he'd made a searing 77th minute break through the Welsh defence.
Well, look where Scotland are now, though, deeper in their own half, now through. Stuart Hogg is there. Stuart Hogg on a stumble from the captain, looking for a hat-trick try to win it.
Listen, it could happen to a bishop. There's no need for you to endlessly replay this moment in your mind over and over and over again, Hoggy. There'll be plenty more Grand Slam chances for you in this improving Scotland team. Stay tuned for more Hogglebox Watch Hog Hogwatch when the Six Nations returns in 2 weeks' time.
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up
terrified
winning the bloody World Cup. I love it.
Stuart Hogg. I believed in the boys' ability.
Scotland are a disgrace to work for.
The poor fella got tap-tackled. Whatever, ankle tapped. Did he not?
No, you're thinking of a different moment.
Oh, yeah, He literally just fell over.
I was thinking of the tap tackle as well. Yeah, there's so much misery packed into every Scottish defeat when they have one that it's hard to remember. Pick one, each one apart from the other.
Oh. Yeah, they say Devon Locke tried to jump the shadow of the grandstand on his way to what would have been a famous Grand National win. I don't know if Stuart Hogg is blaming the floodlights in Murrayfield or whatever, but it was an unfortunate incident.
He got spooked.
Yeah. That's Simon, by the way, piping up before I officially introduce him to the podcast. You're in now, Simon. You've crowbarred yourself in, so
yeah,
welcome.
Sorry about that.
No, you got too excited. I know what it's like. I mean, asking you to sit there and wait for myself and Murph and Ken to talk about rugby before piping up is just, it's an impossible task. Don't worry, by the way, Tom Donaldson and all the other Scottish members of the World Service. We know we're not exactly in a position of strength here when it comes to mocking other national teams. We had our own narrow defeat at the weekend. Narrow enough that for a few brief moments in the closing passages of play, I can't have been the only one with visions of this going through my head. Unfortunately, we didn't have the peak Jonathan Sexton or any Jonathan Sexton to pull out miraculous kicks to get us up the field, or in fact any other means of getting the ball within drop goal range. And so it's two defeats from two to pore over with Shane Horgan and Andrew Trimble today. Ken, we haven't had your thoughts on any of the rugby. What did you think of the Six Nations weekend?
I didn't see any of it on.
Great stuff, Ken. We'll save you for the football podcast later. Well, this is one of two Monday podcasts. Don't forget, we'll give you a little football hit later today ahead of two full football pods during the week on Tuesday and Thursday. And it is a big week with a struggling Liverpool playing RB Leipzig in the Champions League and Barcelona against Paris Saint-Germain also. The Monday pod will be available to everybody. That's the quick Monday podcast. You'll need to be a member to hear those full pods later in the week. So please sign up now on secondcaptains.com for a fiver a month to listen to all our football coverage. Also coming up very soon on the World Service.
And who wrote it?
I can't remember his name.
I'll tell you who wrote it.
Yeah, it's a brand new edition of the I'll Tell You Who Wrote It Second Captain's Book Club. I think I can speak for everyone when I say how impressive Gary O'Toole was in his recent contributions to the Where Is George Gibney podcast. He's a hell of a person, a hell of a swimmer in his day as well. And Gary has kindly agreed to come on the book club to review what he tells us is his favourite sports book of all time. It's called Gold in the Water, The True Story of Ordinary Men and Their Extraordinary Dream of Olympic Glory by P.H. Mullen. This book is about a training group of, I haven't read it myself yet, so I'm looking forward to this one, a training group of swimmers in California trying to qualify for the Summer Olympics in 2000. It apparently has sporting excellence, interpersonal rivalries, friends become enemies, become friends, etc. And it's an absolute classic. It is also Gary's favourite sports book, Murph, so that's all the excuse I need to dip my eyes onto this book. You know what I'm saying? Read the book is what I should have just gone for there. Simplified things. We'll be reviewing it next month, so you've plenty of time now as members to order it via Kindle or in hard copy form. And there's also plenty of time for you non-members to become members and become part of our book club. Now let's talk about what went down this Six Nations weekend.
Back to Campbell, back to Duggan, McLaughlin going for that line, and Ireland are in and over.
Simon, this is the bit you're supposed to be coming into the show. How are you?
How are you doing?
No peak Sexton, no Sexton of any form, as I said, no Conor Murray either. New halfbacks, any sense of a new direction for the team or anything to be positive about before we get stuck into the negatives?
I think we need to analyse the game in the context of France butchering a try, hitting the post with a penalty, and our try coming actually from a lost line out, sort of a freak moment, which can happen as well. And we were doughty and stuck in there. And our defensive line-out's way better. Attacking line-out's way better. We have a maul. Paul O'Connell's doing his job. And when we were pragmatic, I thought we were quite good at being pragmatic. It's just that a team at France's level knows that, well, that's fine. If we go ahead and they remain that way, we don't have to do too much. They can sort of play within themselves, which I thought they did for most of the second half, whilst also looking like they could win it quite easily. They didn't sort of go ahead and do that. They acted actually a little bit like old France at times. But I really would worry about the way our attack is going. I think you can see like things like line out and maybe even defence get fixed quite quickly. But our attack hasn't moved that on at all under Cat and Farrell. And if you look at the halfbacks, right? So Byrne and Gibson Park all played okay. No moment that made you think they might be the answer, but not drastic either. But they all played almost exactly the same way as Sexton and Murray do. So when you're analysing the halfbacks, I think we need to take into account that they seem to be following orders, all of them, quite rigidly. And crucially, so when we're looking, say, pundits and fans are looking for new halfbacks, say Casey or Cooney or Harry Byrne or Carty or Frawley, whoever it may be, we need to recognise that they will all be asked to do the same thing, because it's clearly coming from Cat and Farrell and whoever else is in the management team there that's in charge of attack. And so what really would change in the long run if we were to bring in, say, Casey and Harry Byrne for the Italy game?
Okay, well, it's another Six Nations weekend, another Ireland defeat for Shane and Andrew to get stuck into. Hi, Shane.
Yeah, how you doing?
Suitably downbeat. Andrew, how are you?
All good, all good.
I know this was seen on paper as less winnable than the one against Wales, but it turned out to be winnable. I mean, we were very much in it for large periods of the game. So how did we lose it?
I think we, for long periods of the game, we played quite sensible rugby. We played the type of rugby that you'd expect at that sort of level whenever weather conditions aren't perfect. And we kicked a lot of ball from our half, which is okay. We kicked a couple of times from their half, which probably isn't as okay. And maybe we didn't show quite as much ambition as we might have, but I think that's probably reflected in we can't execute the way they execute, the way they got their try. Like we did everything right most of the first half, and they get one opportunity and then they score from it, but that's a reflection of where they're at and what they can do, and their X factor. And Jalibert put the ball back inside to Marchand, offload to Dupont, outside to Penault. It was incredible. It was really, really impressive rugby. I just don't think that we can do that.
Yeah, I thought our set piece was quite good, and some of our forwards' basics were really good, Shane. But when we're asked to be more than pragmatic, and there were times in the game that it obviously demanded it, it just never felt like our attack even had a third gear, never mind a fourth or fifth.
Our stats were really good. If you look through them again, you'd say, you know, why didn't Ireland win that game? But you'd be looking at stats through a prism of a few years ago. And I think this is quite a crucial point. We had the line out won all our line outs, excellent. Very low penalty count. I think we had 5 penalties, which is incredible. And where you'd want to be, we had more meters made, we had more possession, more territory. But there's a change in rugby that's gone on that myself and Andrew were in the middle of the Joe Schmidt era. And he brought a change to rugby, which was a possession-based game. So the more you kept the ball, the longer you had it for, the more likely you would break down the opposition defence and or they would make an error. So what you'd have to do then is keep the ball for as long as you can. Make sure you're very accurate to break down. Recycle, recycle, recycle. Get the penalty. Wait for someone to make a mistake in the defensive line and you get a break, potentially a try. That's less of an option against the defences at the moment because they are better. They're better structured. They're faster line speed. And it's almost better not to have the ball. But what you need to have then, instead of having masses of possession, you have to be able to have this, the ambition, the skill level, and the strategy that when you have a chance, that you magnify a half a chance into a full chance by doing something that we saw France do when they had the ball. And generally, the best way to do that is to be able to offload the ball. And Ireland aren't an offloading team. And to Andrew's point, is it tactical or do we not have the players to do it? I think it's a little bit of both. I don't think we practice it and it's not in our philosophy in the same way as it is in France's. That's a problem with, you know, structurally with our thinking, both from Andy Farrell, but also maybe in our provinces a little bit. And because we don't do it as much as those French players do, either in their clubs or with the national team, and it's not valued in the same way, then the players themselves lose the skill set, and it becomes something that we do as a last resort. And we saw that last resort with two players near the end. There's a couple of minutes to go, and we saw Jameson Gibson Park and James Lowe offload the ball a couple of times, and it was maybe the best sequence of rugby we had in the game. But that was when it was the game felt as if it was lost, and we had to do something really special. That's not enough. We have to seize the moments within the game, and where they're on to offload the ball, and there were many that we offload the ball.
I think there's we have to be able to do both. We have to be able to combine a pragmatic approach whenever the weather's not quite what you'd want it to be to play that style of rugby, and it's a test match, so it's inevitably going to be slightly more tense. I think you have to combine a little bit of pragmatism with a little bit of execution and throwing caution to the wind occasionally whenever it's appropriate. And that was a good example. Having said that, James Lowe and Jameson Gibson Park, so Park has no option. Gibson Park has to throw that because he's going into touch. He has to throw that offload. James Lowe runs straight and then puts the pass behind Gibson Park. Gibson Park then runs into touch. So there's an incredible bit of skill execution there, but there's no pragmatism. He just runs into touch. The clock, it's 78 minutes and we need over 2 points behind. So I agree, there's incredible, like really, really good level of execution, but you have to combine that with some, you have to be sensible at test match level. And at times we weren't.
Well, maybe the time we really did that, sorry Shane, was that the try that we all thought James Lowe had scored until eventually seeing his trailing leg touch in. It was almost an amazing finish. But even with that one, it seems like everyone is in agreement, including I think Andy Farrell alluded to it afterwards, that he didn't name Hugo Keenan by name, but he was saying if we just taken the ball up another 5 metres, committed the last defender, that's an easy sort of a try. So that's not even awful. That's nothing fancy. That's just basic execution. No?
I'm not certain about
me neither.
I've looked at it a good few times.
So everyone's not in agreement then.
Well, yeah, no. I've looked at it a good few times. I don't think Keenan has got fully round the outside, so he can draw the last man. The last man has actually bought time quite well, allowed the inside defenders to cover, and they would have tracked down Keenan. And then the French defender was on James Lowe. So I think if he had taken any more out of that, he would have eaten up the space, and actually James Lowe would have got hit man and ball. The fact that he gave it slightly earlier, I think he gave James Lowe a chance to do what he nearly did, which is catch the ball with time and a tiny little bit of space to actually try power through the final tackle. And to be honest with you, in those sort of spaces, I would be thinking, well, giving James Lowe a one-on-one isn't really a bad, a bad outcome. So, listen, I'm not defending overall the Irish back attacks, because I thought, one, as Andrew pointed there, the idea of kicking a ball off first phase from a line out in, you know, on the 10-metre line is not what we should be doing. And it shows an incredible lack of ambition and forethought. And when we were playing multi-phase, I thought we looked, you know, stagnant. We didn't take the ball to the line. And I was really, really disappointed what we were doing from a back's perspective to try and break down the opposition. But in that single instance, I don't think Hugo Keenan did much wrong.
On that one, I thought, so that's, that we've seen that play a million times, go to Henshaw and then just go out the back of Ringrose. It goes out the back of Ringrose to 10, and then usually your ideal shape is Hugo being straight and wide outside that, and Earlsey just being off the shoulder, but being kind of shown enough to interest Penno. And I actually thought Earlsey got a little bit tucked. He might have just got left behind a little bit. So that meant that he wasn't as big a threat, and then it meant Penno could get off. I think it was actually Gilfiku kind of tucked under to make the to help out Doolan. But I thought Earlsey on that occasion, if he had shown a little bit more, he would have got more interest from Penno, and then we would have got more space from Hugo. Hugo would have picked off the not quite a 2-on-1, but he would have given James Lowe a little bit more space. But I agree, Hugo spotted, here's an opportunity for me to get it into James Lowe's hands early. And he's always going to be a guy who wins the one-on-one. I thought it was actually quite switched on, if you go, and it's strange the way people interpret one way or the other, and it's complete opposites. Hugo's very switched on. He's done it. That's a great job. Or he's had a shocker. Yeah. I do think,
well,
actually...
His coach alluded to it, as I said, without naming him. He alluded to the one opportunity where that happened, and that was the only opportunity in the half. So
Hugo did. He did get caught going a little bit sideways in general. I thought that one, it was excusable, but I thought... Maybe Hugo, maybe Ringrose once or twice. I thought once we go one pass outside 10, we do look a little bit sideways. And I don't think we execute quite as well when we get into the space.
Yeah, Raj analysed it quite well afterwards, and I thought he was spot on in terms of we looked sort of one-paced in the back line, and we also looked lateral, like just everything constantly going the same way. Nobody cutting against the grain, no sort of deception. But he also said something interesting. I thought that we can close the gap on France quite quickly, Shane.
Well, maybe it's something he thinks he could do in a few games.
I always feel he's watching French rugby so close up. He sort of feels there's a pathway there.
There's a couple of things. I think there would have to be a fairly significant change in the overall philosophy of this team, because, and I don't want to labour it, but, you know, the kicking game from that position, you know, that's not where we should be going. We should be going to, and that sort of speaks of something else. It speaks of kind of a lack of trust in the backs to do what backs should be able to do. And the previous point that I made about, you know, how the game has changed and having long periods of possession, multi-phase possession, aren't really as beneficial as they used to be. But actually having set piece ball off good set piece, and we've seen a significant change in the quality of our line-out ball and consistency in our line-out ball, that is what we should be eating up. And so whoever the coach is, whoever the backs coach is, and whoever the 10-12 combination are, should be saying, listen, we're taking that. We have a pre-plan move in this area based on the analysis that we've done against the opposition, and we're going to deliver it now. So that side of things should be, you know, I think, you know, very easy to move on, and that is, you know, that is a really decision-making process necessary, more than a skill process, because there's still a skill level necessary in that set piece. If you can't deliver that from a back's perspective, we are really in trouble. I think, but then the next phase, though, the multi-phase play is more complex. It does, I think, require a movement away from the philosophy that we have, as I said, which is predominantly ruck focused, to retaining a more offloading option. And I think, you know, even when we did get a couple of offloads away, it did look as if the player who's getting the offload is quite surprised to take it. So that means that there's actually more knock-ons or potential knock-ons, and that then leads to a decrease in the number of offloads that we do. And then secondly, very often the players, so the next support player isn't in a position to take the next potential offload, because if you offload, you make the break, you're gone through, then you actually leave your attacking line behind. And unless there's some anticipation that this player could, the first offload could occur, it makes the second offload more difficult, because you don't have the support. But not only does it make the second offload more difficult, it means that attacker could potentially get isolated as well. So that is a significant philosophical change.
It's a team philosophy. Yeah, it has to be.
It's a team philosophy in what you do. And I do think that would take a little bit more time to bed in. Now, we've talked about how this Irish team could progress and what support they would get if they do progress. If we saw that progression, I think, you know, I would be incredibly excited by it. And I think that, again, there would be a support, you know, generally from the commentary, but also from, you know, the wider country, to go, right, we can see Ireland trying to do something quite different here. The ultimate benefit is going to be, payoff is going to be significant, and there's a few tough days in between. I don't think we're quite there at the moment.
Andrew, with all that said, how much heat is Andy Farrell under now, do you think? How much pressure?
I think he's under a bit of pressure, all right. And I think you need to get a bit of luck. And I don't think Ireland really have had that much luck. I think they could have won yesterday, and they could have won at Wales, easily could have beaten Wales. And whenever you look at, by contrast, Wales have been poor, probably. I think they've been better than they were a lot of last year, but still not that good at Six Nations level compared to what we're used to of Wales over the last 15 years.
They still get the job done against 14 men every week, but
but you know, like they will probably get a lot of confidence from those two wins, and they're actually sitting top at the minute, and they're sitting pretty, having not really played that well. So they've got a bit of luck. I think if Ireland start getting red cards out of their opposition, yeah, then they'll be in good shape. But yeah, I think he's under pressure. I do think he's under pressure. It's a nice time for the Italy game. It's always nice to get that Italy kind of confidence booster at some stage during the Six Nations if things aren't going well. But, you know, England coming to Dublin and then going to Scotland, it's looking really, really difficult, I think.
Shane, on Farrell?
I still think he has a bit of time, but that time will run out relatively quickly if there's bad performances and bad results against England and Scotland, and that could happen quite easily. So I think how he can future-proof himself against that is to, you know, change what they're doing quite significantly, and there is an opportunity to do that against Italy, and I think he should take it. They're going to win against Italy; they certainly should. But I think it's the manner of the performance and also the selections again for the Italy against Italy are quite significant. You know, what are we gaining now from this Six Nations? We're not going to win the Six Nations. We're not going to win a Grand Slam or a Triple Crown. That's all gone. So, you know, the difference between... This is the perfect Six Nations now to use for development. And if we don't use it to development, I think it just looks like we are, you know, Andy is you know, being ultra pragmatic just to get over the line to win a game. And I don't actually think that's the core thing here. And I think, as I said, the game against England and Scotland will be particularly difficult. So we need to see, you know, progress in them games. And, you know, if we do, again, I think he buys himself even more time. And I also think it's not about buying him time. It's actually progressing the side to being a side that, you know, is going to have a good Six Nations next year and a decent World Cup into the future. But I think they have to make some relatively significant changes. And I did see something in the Welsh game, like the germ of it. But it was after 10 minutes, we could see no more. And then, you know, to some degree, I could understand the restrictions that this French game posed. And I suppose what he thought, thinking the victory in that was most important, and it really, you know, maybe it was, home game and Six Nations still to play for. That's gone now, so let's see the progression.
When you see the difference in our defensive line-out, our maul, our scrum since Paul O'Connell came on board, and I'm going to choose to give him some of the praise for that, or a lot of the praise for that, because certainly with the line-out, it's chalk and cheese from last year. When you see how one assistant coach can change one area of the game, I just wonder how much, we're constantly talking about Farrell, but how much pressure Mike Catt is under. And, well, for me, the most worrying bit is the attack. I think the other bits can probably get solved relatively quickly in certain ways. But just when your attack lacks bite, it just sort of feels like nothing really, truly good can ever happen, Shane.
Yeah, Catt's under, I think, significant pressure. He's been with the team over a year. We haven't seen, I don't think, any particularly innovative back play. I don't think we look, I don't think we're maximizing the talents that we have. You've mentioned there, Paul O'Connell, the significant changes that he's, you know, I can see his fingerprints over it. So I think he has made a change, and good coaches will will make significant changes pretty quickly. The next phase of that becomes more difficult, but getting to the base standard where you're winning all your line-out ball and you're disrupting the opposition to some degree, you know, good coaches will have that immediate effect. We've also seen similarly with Edwards in France, he came into the defensive system that was at sixes and sevens, really quickly got them to a base level that's really good. Yeah. And then it's like, how do you kick on to the, you know, the super extreme level? And that's what he's in the process of doing now, and I'm sure Paul will be in the process of dealing with Ireland. We haven't seen Mike Cant have a similar influence in the Ireland setup with regard to, you know, back play or attacking play, either off set piece or off multi-phase. So again, you know, we have a game against Italy that allows us to explore this area and to progress it. And if we don't do that, we don't see it in the next game. And then if we don't see it in the next game, we're unlikely to see it against England and Scotland, really. If we don't, and those results are bad, then there's a huge amount of pressure heaped on Mike Capp, because he has been given a significant amount of time, and we're yet to see the results.
Okay, I'll come back to the possible selection against Italy then, but just on the other big game of the weekend. Unfortunately, Shane, when it comes to Scotland predictions, when Murph wins, it means you loses, and your boys, your Tartan Army, let you down at the weekend. What a game, though.
Yeah, well, it was a great game, but it was an annoying game, let me tell you, from my perspective.
For Scottish fans like
For yourself. Scottish fans, and I wanted Scotland to win for loads of reasons, but I really like the way they play. I think they are exciting. They're in great game. They make up so many great games in the Six Nations, and sort of make what Six Nations is to me in many ways. But I just when you think you've got a little bit of hope, they just extinguish it almost as quickly. And it was quite, I said at the weekend, it was quite unbelievable that they lost that game. Not just from the outset, because if the narrative of the game was slightly different, then maybe more understandable. But the fact that they got into such a good position, that they were so dominant, you thought, you know, they should have been winning by, I said, 30 points at half time. They crucially gave up the try just before half time. You know, then had an opportunity to maybe put the game within doubt, but they had the disallowed try under the post. Then, you know, Ferguson gave away the penalty and the red card that you would have thought, in light of what had gone on the week before, would have been an uber hot topic for everyone. And recognizing that if you're down to 14 men, you know, in a Six Nations, you're going to lose. And then it was almost game over. But somehow Scotland, when they went behind, it was almost entirely Scotland again. They came back into it. You know, I thought, oh, hang on a second, they have a chance of winning this game. Then threw it away again. And then in the last couple of plays, and certainly with the very last play of the game, I thought they were through for another try. But somehow, you know, tap tackle, missed it and managed to make a mistake. Now, their box office, but they're breaking my heart here.
Box office, but breaking Shane's heart. Andrew, what do you think of the Scots?
Yeah, it's hilarious to see that it's so Scottish. And then I know, Simon, you're talking about this as well, about Hogg's break up the right-hand side. And doesn't he fall over? The most Scottish thing. it's heartbreaking from them, for someone who's so close to them like you, Shaggy, but for the rest of us, it's hilarious.
I do worry, actually, because with Hogg, Hamish Watson, Gray, Finn Russell, Redpath, Vanamerva, they're not going to put a collection of players like this together again. And they're going to have max, say, 2-3 seasons together before two or three of them get injured or get older or run out of form or whatever.
If they don't do it this year, which they haven't done and won't do, it's like, when does it happen? And it almost becomes more difficult year on year if you get to, you know, crucial points like they did this year. I honestly think it could be defining for this whole generation of Scottish players. If they had won that game in the manner that they looked as if they were going to win it, it could have been a real jumping up off point for them. I don't know if they would have beat Ireland at home, but they would have been playing for a triple crown, and that's not a position that they've been in for a long time. And, you know, they could be potentially playing an Irish team that is feeling the pressure as well. Now, that, although I think it'll be a difficult assignment for Ireland, that becomes a lot more balanced of a game when it occurs. So you know, and so what position are Scotland in then? They've gone through this season where they've had a one-off win against England, as opposed to they've been building something over time with a golden generation of rugby players that can play at a high level, and they've found some, they've, you know, moved away from the fragility that we've seen year after year after year, the lack of consistency, to being able to pull a big performance out but not being able to back it up. It's, you know, if you were writing a really hackneyed article about Scotland, you would have said this is what happened.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
not saying Murph is hackneyed, but but it, you know, that is what you would say. Oh, so, oh yeah, they have the big win against England the first time in 30 years. You know, they're Wales are in not a great position. It's a home game the week after, and everyone expects them to win. What happens? They blow it, and they did blow it. And at some point, they're going to need to put a couple of wins together, and, you know, a win out of adversity as well. And again, the opportunity was there, even when they were down to 14 men, to pull that win out of adversity, and they failed to take it. And if they continue to fail to take it, as I said, it becomes more difficult. And then they, you know, at what point do they take it? At what point do they turn it around? It's not as if, you're right, Simon, they have generation after generation of brilliant players coming through. They don't. So if they don't do it with this, it could be a very long time before they get in a position where they have an opportunity for a triple crown again.
Not to overstate it, but Shaggy's talking about the impact or the importance for Scotland, you know, taking this opportunity with the golden generation to actually kick on and do something really, really important for Scottish rugby. The implications could be wider because the Pro 14 desperately needs more competition, more players, more high-profile players with a little bit of stardust, a little bit of X factor. And Scotland have these guys, and if they can bring them back in, who will benefit more from the Pro 14 being more competitive than the Irish provinces? We need this nearly as much as they need it. So it has wider implications rather than just Scottish rugby.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Back to the Irish setup for the Italy game. Shane says he wants to see changes, a progressive team. What does that mean in particular, Andrew, around the halfbacks? Because, I mean, this is the, we see the situation we're in now with Murray and Sexton, and nobody really established to take over from them. So who would you like to see play at scrum half and out half against Italy if you're picking the team in the morning?
Well, Craig Casey not getting off the bench probably shows where Farrell sees him, and it's not like Jameson Gibson-Park was having a blinder. He plays well. He ups the tempo. He increases the pace of the game definitely, but he's a little bit loose, and I think that looseness cost us a little bit. He doesn't quite execute to the same accuracy that Murray does, but that's the price you pay whenever you up the pace. He brings more intensity and more pace on the ball. But even despite him playing like that, Craig Casey didn't get off the bench, so that kind of shows where he sees Casey. That to me says he's going to invest more time in Gibson Park. If he plays Casey, then, you know, I'm happy to be wrong there, and it'd be great to see a young, exciting talent there. I know you boys are probably talking about Harry Byrne, but for me, I don't know if I see the value in that. I don't know if I see the value in putting, you know, Johnny starts the first game, then Billy plays a bit of rugby, then Ross Byrne comes in, and then you go to Harry Byrne. I don't see the point in putting a little bit of game time in four players. I think you pick one, and the other one is, and obviously it's Johnny, but the other one is either Billy or Ross.
Which would you pick? And I know it's hard to judge Billy Byrne's fully on the last game, having to go off, but who would you go for?
Yeah, he did okay. To be honest, like, big part of me, you know, I thought Billy Byrne did okay. It was reasonably unremarkable. He missed one kick goal and got the other one, I suppose. But Ross Byrne, this big part of me actually feels really sorry for Ross Byrne, because he's been marred by two England defeats, and no 10 in the world was going to come out looking good whenever their pack get hammered at Twickenham. And it was nice to see him actually, you know, do okay. I think he still sat off the line a little bit, but he did okay. He put a bit of an imprint onto the game. I don't think either of them are putting their hands up and saying pick me, which probably buys into the case I think we're just about to hear.
Well, we might be. Shane, go on. Who do you want to make the case for?
Well, to the point that Andrew made there about sticking with Billy or Ross Byrne, you know, do we see Billy Byrne as somebody, Billy Burns, sorry, I keep...
there's a lot of Byrne and Burns around at the moment, yeah.
Do we see Billy Burns as somebody who's, we want to drive Ireland forward in the post-Sexton era into the next World Cup and beyond? I honestly don't think he's that person. Ross Byrne is having a very difficult season. His kicking, those kicks he made were really remarkable. I thought it was a lot of bottle, you know, tough kicks, really well struck, excellent. But his attacking play, and taking the ball to the line was, you know, really off the pace. He was, again, standing very statically, delivering the passes. And I know probably our momentum didn't help that, but he has got into that habit. And it needs to be addressed really quickly, or he's going to, you know, he's never going to be the sort of 10 that we'd like him to be. So what is our thinking here? Do we go, we're playing against, as I said at the start, we're playing against Italy. We're not in a position to win the Six Nations or be in any way successful in it. So let's maybe jump skip a generation and look at someone like Harry Byrne. Look at Frawley, either at 10 or 12, and give them an opportunity to say, right, listen, let's see how you can go. And I think I have to, you know, take some, you know, responsibility. I think we sometimes overthink the how important experience is, and we undervalue players coming in without any baggage and the ability to look at things more freshly and excited by playing for Ireland and, you know, having ambition and knowing that they need to perform. And I think, you know, looking at that level or skipping that level that, you know, that Billy Byrne and Ross Byrne are on might really be valuable. And it's where we need to get to. So why not get there earlier? Why not give a few first caps out? Why not see how people go? And if you're telling me, you know, Ross Byrne or JJ Hanrahan or Frawley can't compete against Italy at international level, I don't agree with you.
Yeah, and I think it would be almost to double down on the mistakes we've already made by saying, oh, well, we give Billy and Ross an amount of time, so we should give them a bit more. I think there's so few opportunities anyway before the next World Cup, and if you don't take it against Italy, I think there's sort of a growing swell of belief there that we need to take a bit of a risk here, just give the next guys a bit of a chance. And I actually think Farrell and Cat and the rest of them will be under more pressure if they don't do it in the Italy game.
It's more of a risk for Farrell than it is for Fabien Galthié because of the setup where those guys get their exposure, and there's a lot of guys getting a lot of game time. Jalibert had played a season before he got brought in. It wasn't Galthié, actually, to be fair, brought him in at the start, but Ntamack had played a lot of rugby for Toulouse. Harry Byrne has only played in a second string Leinster team against teams that are nowhere near the level that these guys are competing at. In top 14, I don't know how much European rugby he's played. Frawley's played a bit more, I suppose, but not at 10. And then Andy Farrell maybe looks like he's being conservative as a result, but it's a way riskier strategy bringing these guys in because they've had no exposure. Then whenever you look at Jalibert, first of all, the talent that's available in France is incredible. So it's almost easier to do it. So I think Andy Farrell's kind of taking the brunt of a difficult setup or kind of difficult circumstances, so he looks conservative, but it's not a reflection of how much risk he's being asked to take.
And Trims, who do you think the risk sits at? What is the risk? You know, is the risk that Andy Farrell will look, you know, silly, and, you know, it might jeopardize his position, or the risk is that negatively affect the futures of these younger players, or, you know, Ireland lose a game against Italy? Well, you know, what's the key risk that you think that are potentially open as a result of taking that sort of generational change? And I don't think it should just be in those positions either. I think there are a couple of other options as well that we could go into.
No, in terms of the Italy game, I don't think there's much risk. I don't think there's that. It's good to get a young fella like that, get exposure and get their foot in the door and give them an opportunity to maybe just grow in confidence and grow in experience there. I think it's probably more risky from Farrell, even just his personal brand or his personal perception. It's more risky for him not to do it because then he's just going to, people are going to buy into this conservative thing, or you're just picking what you've always picked and you're always going to get what you always got. So I think from him personally, if it just came down to him, I think he'd be wise to pick Harry Byrne, Kieran Frawley, because then he's just going, it's more of a disclaimer. Well, I tried something, didn't quite work, and it gives him more of a case to go back to what worked before.
Shane, we're going to wrap up, but just maybe give us a couple of those names then that you want to see in the team before we go, and we can get back to it next week.
Well, I think I think it was more of a philosophical approach to change in that, and I do think that would mean potentially looking at that 10-12 axis. It's, you know, it's something that I'm sure I've bored you guys with going on about, but it does change the shape of our attack. Now our two centres are playing, you know, very well in the way that they play, but I do think that if you had a ball player like Frawley at 12, again, who would be a new cap, supplemented by a Harry Byrne or, you know, even a JJ Hanrahan. You know, I know Joey Carberry isn't available, but that sort of model I think would be really interesting and change the way Ireland play. It would give us much more off set piece. It would give us much more off our role in plays as well. I think we could look at our wing as well. I think Earlsey is being asked to do a lot of stuff that he's, you know, although he's performed admirably, I don't think that we really want to get him, you know, chasing box kicks all the time. It's not his best skill set. I think we can look at that area a little bit, and we could look some game time for Larmer as well. And you know, there's I think probably at two as well, we probably need to make the change. Herring was, you know, pretty anonymous through the game. I think it's probably the time to change to Kelleher and you know, bite the bullet on that and look at it as a long term replacement.
We need to be a wee bit careful on that, just because we're all so appreciative and thankful for the impact that O'Connell's had at set piece, and we talked about it. The lineout is just totally unrecognisable, and I'm not saying it wouldn't be with Kelleher, but now that we've got that, maybe we need to be cautious about being too quick to say, right, now that's sorted, let's move on.
We'll stew on those ones for a week or so and then come back to it. Guys, great stuff. Thanks a mil.
Thanks a mil.
Cheers, fellas.
A lot of times you say something on this show and you're like, jeez, you know, that could come back to bite me in the arse now, you know. But like, I can just come out and say what I like about the Scotland rugby team. You'll never ever get a chance to play audio back to me and be like, Murph, what were you thinking? How could you have come out and said such a thing?
Oh, Flood of Scotland,
you understand.
When will we see your like again?
Scotland are a disgrace to world sport.
That fought and died for
the Jots.
Your wee bit hill and glen,
and you cunts,
stood against him.
My name's Jackley McCaffrey.
Proud Edward's army.
You're always on the feeble tail, never fit.
And sent him home.
The Scotland rugby team, the sporting world's greatest pinata.
Do you think again?
Year after year, I'd laugh at the Scottish rugby team, and I'll never be called out. It's an amazing freedom that I have.
Three Scotsmen. It's been that all day, and it's come loose, and Hamish Watson belted it into the sand, and that is it. And 38 years of hurt are over for Scottish rugby.
In even more important rugby news before we wrap things up today, did you guys hear Andy Farrell struggle to outline how he felt about the French doctors speaking about Johnny Sexton's medical history last week? We'll have a listen.
Honestly, I thought it stinked. I thought it stunk on so many grounds. I suppose I'll leave it at that.
Okay, Andy, that's a tricky one. Andy went for it stinked, followed by it stunk.
The correct version, Ken, is actually...
I would have said stank, but
I would have said look, listen, it totally stinkified, but I'll just leave it at that. I'm not going any further into it. It's stinkified and that's it. And
yeah, if you're putting my head in the block to explain the difference between the different times to use stank and stunk, I'd have been struggling. I just know that stinked is wrong. Stinked is definitely wrong.
But isn't it like I stank, I have stunk? Isn't that the difference?
Yeah, I think so. But again, you know, I think either of them, no one would bat an eyelid, you know?
No, I mean, no one would bat an eyelid in either of those cases because both are correct usage.
Mm. But if Andy Farrell had used them, had used stunk or stank, I wouldn't be holding it against him. Stinked, I will forever carry that against him, of course. I'll never forgive that. I'll never forgive and I'll never forget.
Forget the two defeats so far. It's the grammatical issue that you have a problem with. Yeah. More grammar corner perhaps coming up later on in this.
Because everyone loves that. We come across really well as well. Yeah,
that's the
main thing. The important thing is that we would come across great in that scenario.
And there's going to be way more Ken in our football podcast available to everybody later on today. You've been keeping your powder dry so far, Ken, so we'll get stuck into that later on. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken. Thank you,
Simon. Owen, thank you.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Ken. That's Murph.
Thanks, everybody. Chat to you later.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.